Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In an accounting sleight of hand that even politicians might find amazing, it turns out that the big budget cut from last Friday, it really wasn't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, managing over $1.7 trillion in assets, providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Manta.com, providing an online destination for small businesses to be found and to find new customers. More online at Manta.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, everybody, the 14th of April. Good to have you with us. So to review, Republicans won the House last fall by promising to cut $100 billion from the budget. Problem was, the fiscal year had already started by the time they were sworn in, so they prorated it to $61 billion. Negotiations got that to almost $39 billion last Friday in the no-government shutdown agreement. But even as that deal officially passed the House today, we learned the actual amount the government won't be spending is substantially smaller. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale takes it from there.
House Appropriations Committee Chairman Harold Rogers began today's floor debate with a message for freshman Republicans.
If you believe in cutting spending, you can vote for $40 billion of it today. The largest any member of Congress has ever been able to vote for. This is historic.
But a CBO scoring of the budget deal finds actual savings this year are only $350 million, less than 1% of historic. As word spread of the CBO's underwhelming sum, former CBO Director Douglas Holtz Eakin held a conference call to clear up what he called confusion in the press.
First, I think, and most important thing is nothing has changed with regard to the budgetary scoring of this.
Holtz Eakin says the money has to be divided up for salaries and contractors and programs, and that takes time. And CBO is only counting the savings between now and October.
As it turns out, the federal government does spending in much in the way it does most things, slowly and in the most complicated fashion possible.
He says we'll see the $38 billion in savings, but over a number of years. And for economist David Weiss at Standard & Poor's, that's fine, since quick cuts would undermine the economic recovery anyway.
What's of concern is not this year, it's that you can't continue to borrow 10% of GDP every year without making ourselves look like Greece Part 2.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Perusing the news today, there was a vague feeling of deja vu all over again out there. A Senate committee released a report trashing Wall Street for its conduct during the financial crisis. A story in the New York Times wondered why nobody has gone to jail over it yet. And the new agency set up to monitor financial stability, that is systemic risk, turns out it's been less than completely forthcoming with what it knows. William Black teaches law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. More to the point for our discussion, though, he was a key financial regulator back in the last financial crisis that we had, that of the savings and loans. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So there is this trifecta of things happening today, as I mentioned, that has brought 2008 back to us. And I wonder if we could start with this deceptively simple but maybe complicated question. Why has it been so difficult to prosecute and to regulate and then to move on from the events of 2.5, 3 years ago?
Well, in part because we think of it as if it were 2 to 3 years ago. In fact, the FBI publicly warned in congressional testimony in September 2004 that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud and predicted that it would cause a financial crisis. And people have also forgotten about 1990, 1991, which is when liar's loans really started and California savings and loans. And we knew it was insane as the regional regulators, and we stopped it by normal supervisory means.
Well, then to the question I think a lot of people have, and especially after reading the piece in the Times today, why hasn't anybody gone to jail?
Well, little people have gone to jail, and of course, the answer is they haven't looked.
They, regulators.
Well, good point. They, the regulators, and they, the FBI, have not investigated, which is why this trifecta was necessary. If you go back to the savings and loan crisis, when we had the inevitable National Commission to look at the causes, they had available to them in the public record 1,000 successful felony prosecutions, several thousand successful enforcement actions, and about 800 successful civil suits. And that provided all kinds of facts. Nothing like that exists as to a single one of the major frauds that caused this great recession.
Well, what about the argument, though, that the financial system is so fragile still, and these cases so complicated that we can't really tear things apart with investigations, substantive investigations and prosecutions, because it'll all fall apart again?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We should leave felons in charge of our largest financial institutions as a means of achieving financial stability.
So, yeah, that's funny. I was expecting you to come back with, J.P. Morgan earned $5 billion last quarter. How shaky can they be?
Well, they didn't earn $5 billion. What we did was change the accounting rules to hide the losses, and then we did an amazing amount of off-budget sheet stuff through the Fed. But if you note, you'll see that most of the recent earnings were because they reduced their loss reserves, which is exactly how they created fictional income during the run-up to the crisis.
What do you think, though, of the Dodd-Frank financial reform regulation that's out there?
Well, it wasn't designed to deal with the causes of the crisis. It doesn't deal with the causes of the crisis. It won't prevent future crises.
So have we wasted this crisis?
Yes, in the sense that you're supposed to learn from them. We're not learning the right lessons. In fact, we're learning the wrong lessons. And that kind of failure to learn is almost always due to ideology getting in the way of facts. We got to get back to American pragmatism. Use what works. And boy, this current system does not work.
William Black teaches law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
If even after hearing what Bill Black had to say, you're still looking for an investment opportunity, you might consider apple juice. Juice futures are set to be listed on the Minneapolis Grain Exchange because apple juice is replacing orange juice in a lot of fridges out there. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Apparently, Americans have been comparing apples to oranges, and apples are gaining. Beverage industry consultant Tom Perko says OJ drinking is down. It's about half of what it was 30 years ago. Meanwhile, apple juice consumption tripled during that time.
Especially young drinkers seem to be more interested in drinking it as opposed to orange juice.
Are apples the next hot commodity trade? Commodities broker Michael Smith is skeptical.
There's a lot of different commodities out there that really don't trade. They used to have tiger shrimp on the Minneapolis Exchange.
The Minneapolis Exchange's Rita Maloney says apple juice is different. Big beverage companies approached the exchange looking for a way to protect against apple price spikes after things like freezes. She says demand for apple juice is on the rise.
You've got apple cranberry juice, you've got apple pomegranate juice, and so forth. That blending doesn't really come into play for oranges.
China's consumption of apple juice is also up. Maloney says soon, apple juice futures will be as common as, well, apple pie. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oh, Stacey. Shaky start, strong finish on Wall Street today. Details when we do the numbers. Emperor Akihito of Japan toured the earthquake and tsunami zone today. He spoke to some of the hundreds of thousands of people who've been displaced by that disaster. Latest total cost estimate for all the damage, said to be about $300 billion. So this week, Marketplace's Scott Tong has been talking to people who'll be helping the Japanese economy work off that debt. Today, a would-be entrepreneur and his prescription for kickstarting Japan Inc.
I'm in Tokyo's financial district with 38-year-old Harvard MBA Norihito, or Nori. I can't tell you his last name, and you'll soon find out why.
This is the area of giant big companies crowding.
Nori says this area is full of what he calls herbivores, male non-predator types. They're
kind of weak, quiet, don't go out for drink, they stay home, Their preference is not to be like manly men like that.
Nori says herbivore men don't take risks. They work cushy jobs, Japanese conglomerates like Nori's employer. Except he is about to quit to start his own firm. He hasn't told his bosses yet, hence the radio anonymity. But it's time, he says, to wake up and hunt.
Some people realized after this earthquake that we were sleeping. Like me, maybe.
Arguably, the Japanese economy has been a zombie for decades. Long before this disaster, its exporters faced stiff competition from abroad. Now, customers will figure,
Japanese product is very good, but maybe we should buy half of them from Taiwan or China because they may not have big earthquakes.
In the near term, Japan's exports will fall, as will auto production. Electricity is rationed. The prime minister calls this the worst crisis since World War II. And the term war zone often comes to mind these days when people visit the coastal areas obliterated by the tsunami. Jeff Kingston teaches Japanese history at Temple University's campus in Tokyo.
When I first went to Onagawa, and I just stared around, and there was only one or two buildings standing here and there, and the rest was flattened. First thing I thought of was Hiroshima.
Japan's post-war recovery turned out to be a golden age for its startups. Sony, for one, gave us the transistor radio and the Walkman. Dan Eisenberg teaches entrepreneurship at Babson College.
If you look throughout the history of humankind and you look throughout the history of entrepreneurship, change, chaos, crisis often precedes huge leaps of entrepreneurship and innovation.
Eisenberg says awful times create a mindset of nothing to lose. That's what Nori wants to bring back to Japan. And he's gambling on English language software for Japanese smartphone users preparing to go abroad.
I might have to now open up to outside Japan.
Hold on, though. Most young Japanese already speak English. To demonstrate, we found a couple cooperative locals to read some radio copy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdar.
But first, let's do the numbers.
It's pretty good. Still, Nori argues that most Japanese only speak English when they have to.
We don't like to be speaking with wrong accent or wrong words, you know.
He thinks conversational English is the opportunity. Now, the smart money bets against Nori and an entrepreneur revival in Japan. It's been talked about forever. Venture capital here is scarce, as are young people. Again, Dan Eisenberg at Babson College.
Entrepreneurs are always doing things that other people think are worthless, impossible, or stupid. That's the job of the entrepreneur.
Most of the people who knows me says I'm crazy.
Nori has taken the crazy road before. At Harvard Business School, he skipped the summer internship and joined a national contest to make buffalo wings. He won. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Stocks stumbled out of the gate once again today and then barely made it back to the center line. The Dow Industrials added a tenth of 1%, about 14 points, finished at 12,285. The NASDAQ trimmed off a tiny fraction of a percent, a single point actually, closed at 2760. The S&P 500 finished right back where it's closed for 3 days in a row now, 13-14. What, one has to ask, are the odds? Shares of grocery giant Supervalu soared on higher-than-expected earnings. The owner of Save-A-Lot and Albertsons rallied at nearly 17% today. When in doubt, investors go for consumer staples. Coca-Cola shares fizzled up 1.5%. Kraft Foods cooked up another 1.75% gain today. Bond prices slipped. That puts the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. Marketplace Innovations Desk is supported by Jaguar. You can experience the 2011 Jaguar XJ at a local dealer or visit JaguarUSA.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for March. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly industrial production report. And an international summit on water in developing countries takes place at the National Press Club. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been 2 months since protests forced Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak from office. He and his sons are under investigation for corruption and worse. The Egyptian army is in charge, overseeing the transition to what is expected to be a more democratic government and economy. Faiza Albunaga is the Minister of Planning and International Cooperation in Egypt. That puts her in charge of all economic assistance coming from outside the country, which includes aid from the United States. She's in Washington this week for meetings at the World Bank. And when we spoke this afternoon, I asked her about Egypt's political changes and its economic challenges.
Of course, a revolution is like an earthquake on the economy, and it has its aftershocks. Egypt is a country that has a varied economy, but all the components of the national income of Egypt have been severely hit. Tourism, you know, Egypt is probably one of the first touristic destinations of the world. We have lost that in a significant manner, to the extent that 70% of the permanent contract employees in Egypt lost their jobs and hence lost their income. But of course, new foreign direct investment is still not coming in the way that we would like to see.
Well, let me ask you about that foreign direct investment. You met with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today.
Yes.
You've been meeting with American businesses. What assurances can you offer, can the Egyptian government offer, that Egypt is a worthwhile and, more importantly, a safe place for American businesses to invest right now?
Well, actually, those who are already investing in Egypt know why Egypt is a very good place for investment, because of the location, of course, because of the fact that it provides a competitive labor force, because of the fact that it has access to the whole world in terms of maritime roads, in terms of access to the Arab world, and also in terms of access to Africa. Egypt is back to business and is widely open to business.
You're meeting also with the World Bank at their meetings this weekend. You're going to, I presume, speak with U.S. government officials. What's your sense of how the American government and the World Bank and the Western world in general is dealing with Egypt's transformation right now?
The events, of course, has resulted in a very huge deficit, $12 to $15 billion. This is a huge amount for Egypt to handle on its own under the present circumstances. The time is of the essence, and during this transitional period, what we need is to inject a cash flow into the economy in order to provide and manage the expectations of the population. They want jobs, they want to increase their income, they want to be able to afford decent houses. All of these are the pillars of our immediate priorities.
But is it really that close at hand? I mean, what happens if you don't get the aid and the assistance you say you need?
Well, actually, you see, this is not about aid, and this is a point that I want to make clear, because as a matter of fact, what we have asked from our American friends is to actually work on a debt forgiveness. We owe the United States about $3.6 billion, but that is not the principal debt owed to the United States. What we owe right now is interest upon interest upon interest. Again, this is not about aid and assistance. This is about mutual strategic interest, because if Egypt goes wrong, the whole region goes wrong, and that act is not good for the United States.
There are, though, as I'm sure you've seen just in the papers the last few days while you've been in this country, serious discussions happening about the budget and about foreign aid in this country and about the possibility that we should just get rid of all foreign
aid. Yeah, that's why we talked about debt forgiveness, because we think that has the least impact on the Treasury. We're fully cognizant of the constraints on the federal budget. But then I always say that I'm sure and I'm confident that the U.S. can actually cut down on spending, but it cannot cut down on its strategic interests.
Faiza Albunaga is the Egyptian Minister of Planning and International Cooperation. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
One more note from the Middle East before we move on. Political disagreement within NATO over how aggressively to pursue the no-fly zone is playing out on the ground. The International Organization for Migrants said today a relief ship has docked in Misrata, that's out in western Libya, to deliver supplies and evacuate refugees. But shelling from pro-Gaddafi forces has stopped everything right in its tracks. Okay, so you're ready for some football? Are you ready for some mediation? The NFL and its players restarted talks in Minneapolis today. It's the first meeting since the lockout began about a month ago. Main issue hasn't changed: how to split the $9 billion the league brings in every year. But commentator John Wertheim says any eventual deal is going to be driven by far more personal calculations.
If you've ever peered into a player's parking lot at a stadium or seen athletes gambling in Vegas or ordering dinner at a steakhouse, you know this. These are not men of modest tastes. Nor would you expect them to be. These are alpha males in the meaty years of their lives in a line of work where median salaries run well into seven figures. But what happens when the paychecks stop coming? We've heard a lot already about rookie wage scale proposals and ancillary revenues and an equitable way to apportion a $9 billion pie. But the labor dispute may well turn on this fulcrum. How long can the NFL players make do without the weekly checks they'd otherwise receive during the 17 weeks of the season? It's easy for the players to profess unity and take a hardline stance in April. But what happens to the solidarity and demands when the money spigot runs dry, when bills come due for everything from boat and car payments to property taxes? The Players Association, and as much as it still exists, is well aware of this issue. For months, the union's been issuing texts and emails and pamphlets encouraging players to SYM, save your money. NFLPA President Kevin Mawai has said that for 2 years now, he's been encouraging players to start saving money, cut down on their lifestyle, and be ready for the worst-case scenario. The more cash reserves the players build up, the more leverage they'll have. And that's in part because, football or no football, owners will have to account for the debt service on their stadiums, payroll on their office staff, charges on their other businesses. They may not have to worry about missing home mortgage payments, car payments, or even jet payments. But the owners, too, have bills to pay.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He's also the co-author of Scorecasting, the hidden influence behind how sports are played and games are won. Here's a hint. It's the refs. Got a comment? Send it to us, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Paying to park your car on a public street is one of those things you just kind of have to do. It's not like parking meters are going away, and they do keep people from hogging the best spots all day. And as an added bonus, parking can be a pretty good moneymaker when cities are short of cash. And there are a whole lot of cities in exactly that situation right now. Cities that are trying to make ends meet by leasing out parking to the private sector. From the Public Radio Transportation Nation Project at WNYC, Andrea Bernstein has more.
In New York City recently, Mayor Michael Bloomberg wanted to raise parking rates a quarter an hour. Their response, in a city that's facing thousands of layoffs, outrage. Mayor Bloomberg backed down. But in Indianapolis, the city went a lot further to try and plug a budget hole. It leased out its entire parking system for 50 years. Indianapolis Deputy Mayor Michael Huber explains why.
Try to find a way to enhance revenues so that we could generate more revenues for infrastructure improvements in lieu of general fund tax revenues.
That's government speak for we needed the money. Right about now, every municipal government does. Chicago did a couple years ago and leased off parking management to a private company for more than $1 billion. But the company, Morgan Stanley, immediately raised parking rates around the city to almost universal criticism. One of those critics is Rachel Weinberger, professor of transportation planning at the University of Pennsylvania.
When a private entity purchases a garage, they do it because they think there's a financial positive for them in the long run. They think it's a bargain, so they're buying something at a fire sale.
Weinberger says it's a better idea for the city to just collect more money. She says in Boston, hourly rates were recently raised a quarter after 25 years.
To increase your meter rates one penny per year is just a complete mismanagement of an important asset.
In Indianapolis, rates hadn't been raised for even longer. I asked Deputy Mayor Huber, why did Indy need a private company in order to hike rates?
It would be, I mean, there are a lot of theories. I mean, there's always a question of political will. No mayor or leader wants to be out in front talking about rate increases or tax increases.
Besides, Huber says, Indianapolis made sure that new technology went in before the rate hike, so that as of this spring, what people would notice is that they could pay with a credit card, not the fact that they had to pay more. He says most people in Indianapolis don't even know a private company manages the meters.
Honestly, I think that there just wasn't a lot of attention paid to our parking system because people didn't necessarily see it as an asset.
In Los Angeles and Pittsburgh, plans to lease out parking were resoundingly rejected by the city councils. But Huber says it worked in Indy because there was a level of trust. He says the former Indianapolis mayor, Stephen Goldsmith, did a lot of privatizing in the 1990s and things didn't work out so badly. Goldsmith is now deputy mayor of New York, which has opened the door a tiny crack to privatizing parking. But Goldsmith's boss, Mayor Bloomberg, is on the idea.
What we're not going to do is sell our birthright, take some money to balance the budget today, and leave our kids with a greater liability.
Meantime, the budget staff in New York City Hall is still trying to figure out how to prevent even more layoffs and service cuts. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. By Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which Susan Lucci loses her job. Yes, it's true. Today, ABC canceled two of the three soap operas it still has on the air, All My Children and One Life to Live. Lucci made a career of playing Erica Kane on All My Kids, but the cancellations are pretty much all economics. All My Children averages about 2.5 million viewers a day. Nice, but down 9% from last season. Median age of a typical viewer, and this is the real signal, it's nearly 57 years old. Anybody else out there rearrange their college class schedules to be back with the soaps? I did. Raise your hand. Come on, don't be ashamed. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. The Dow Industrials added 14 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ gave back a single point, a tiny fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 finished flat for the third straight day. Again, I say, what are the odds? You got to write to us and let us know. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, back here in Japan, after the earthquake, there were lost houses and lost jobs.
Even before the earthquake, prices were falling because of the competition from China. Now we're even less sure about what will happen to our company.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.